Sunny skies at 86 degrees. Welcome to this Thursday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. We'll begin with this. All classes at Lithia Springs High School in Douglas County are canceled today. In a statement from the high school, a Lithia Springs high school teacher suffered a self-inflicted gunshot wound at 7:15 a.m. Trent North is superintendent of Douglas County Schools. He told news outlets this was an isolated incident.
While we do not have all the details leading up to the incident, we know that there were no students or staff members present when this took place. The campus has been secured and all students are being kept safely away from the scene of the incident.
Since then, many students have been picked up. However, some may still be at the school. They can be picked up by a parent or guardian, and buses are available to take bus riders home. Again, a Lithia Springs high school teacher suffered a self-inflicted gunshot wound around 7:15 a.m. this morning. The condition of the teacher, although we do know is a male, has not been released. According to other media outlets, when he was transported to the hospital, he was still alive. Again, all classes at Lithia Springs High School have been canceled today. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from Renewal Design Build, providing kitchen and open floor plan renovations for in-town Atlanta. Your home, your life renewed. More information at renewaldesignbuild.com. And from Capital One. You can open a Capital One savings account and discover more about Capital One savings online at CapitalOne.com/reimagineAtlanta. Capital One, welcome to Banking Reimagined.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. In the words of our public media colleague Ira Glass, friends, is this you? Nearly 45 million people get an annual physical exam. That's a lot of folks, but actually it rounds out to just about 177,000 checkups a day. On Closer Look, we've been focusing on health and wellness this week. Dr. Denise Bell Carter is here to give you and me, I guess, a health checkup. You going to take my blood pressure and all that?
Oh, sure.
All right. Well, she's the medical director at Grady Health Center at East Point and chief of service at Morehouse Family Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Bill Carter.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
All right. Here's a question, and I'm asking for Bob in Brookhaven. Is it a must that everyone should get an annual checkup?
Not necessarily. You do have to look at the age of the person. If we have a 20-year-old, 25-year-old, healthy, not necessarily, but when you're getting up in age, I think it does become important to seek medical care and to get your health checkup to make sure everything is okay.
You were giving me that stare when you said when you get up in age. You talking about me? You know, I read an article where the Society for General Internal Medicine had actually put on annual physicals on a list of things doctors should avoid completely for those who are healthy adults. Really? What do you think about that?
I can see why they would say that because, yes, if you are healthy, if you are young and vibrant, chances are the exam will be good. Mm-hmm. However, if you don't get a checkup, you don't check your blood pressure, you won't know. You won't know, and that would create a problem.
If you had to give a percentage of your patients who regularly get those checkups, like you see them every year, it's a habit for them, you know that Mr. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so is going to be there, what would that percentage be?
Well, that's hard for me to say because the majority of my patients have chronic mm-hmm. medical conditions, so I don't really see a lot of patients who are coming for the annual exam. Most of my patients are follow-ups for high blood pressure, diabetes.
And with those patients with those chronic conditions, you want to see them on a routine basis, right? What if you don't? Do you give them a lecture?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Some patients know they have high blood pressure. They'll run out of medication, and they don't bother to come in because they feel fine. They call it the silent killer for a reason. So the blood pressure remains elevated, and subsequently, years later, they're on dialysis because they did not get treatment for the high blood pressure or for the diabetes. So it's very important. They also end up in the emergency room quite often, when they don't follow up.
When they don't follow up and then they eventually do, and do they give a reason? Do they say, well, Dr. Bell-Carter, I just slipped my mind, I've been so busy, or is health cost a factor too?
Health cost is definitely a factor. Patients have to pay co-pays, and it is challenging for a lot of our patients, even those who have insurance. Mm-hmm. Other reasons, some patients, they just are not as diligent with their health care. But many of them, it is because of financial situations.
Before we get into the actual routine exams and all of that, how long should would you think an annual checkup should, like, if you're in and out in 20 minutes, would that be concerning to you? Someone said, well, I went to the doctor, I had a physical, I was out in 20 minutes.
Well, it really depends. So if you have an elderly patient, and we do well checkups for them, those are about 40 minutes or more. Mm-hmm. For a younger person, it can be quicker, 30, 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm. So I'm in my doctor's office. Routine. This is routine. It's going to change for, and you can use me as a test if you want. I am a pretty healthy year old. You know my age, so.
Yes.
Which you may give it away, but what should I expect from my doctor?
So if it depends. If you're coming in for a routine physical exam, mm-hmm. We are going to talk about health maintenance. We're going to talk about things that you should have as a certain-year-old person. For example, let's just say we have a 50-year-old. So they should have their, if it's a 50-year-old female, mm-hmm. she should definitely have her mammogram,
sure.
her colorectal screening tests. Yes. Of course, we would do a blood pressure check, and then we do a lot of type of screening tests. We screen for depression. We counsel on cigarette smoking.
You screen for depression?
Yes. Now, it's recommended that you screen for depression if you have the ability to get that patient services, if they do have it.
Well, I did not mm-hmm. know that.
Yes.
Is that something new?
No, we're just pushing it more now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so blood pressure, colorectal, mammogram,
eye exam, pap smear,
all that good stuff.
We check to make sure you're getting to your dentist. You know, we're looking at everything.
I know you're looking at me because I full disclosure, I have not had my annual checkup in 2 years. I'm getting there. Look at these looks mm-hmm. that I'm getting from our producer, my engineer, Elizabeth. Finley Fox is in the corner giving me the side eye. But I feel okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I go when I have some issues. I sound like a typical
yes.
typical excuse.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying. It's the work. It's the job.
So my thing about that is, if you don't take the time out, ultimately, if something is wrong, the body will let you know.
Sure.
And the job will be here. And the person might be laid out on their back. So it's important to take mm-hmm. out the time for your health.
What questions should I be asking my doctor? We've had these conversations before that often sometimes patients don't know what to ask their primary care physician when they go to these annual checkups.
So if the patient is experiencing any particular symptoms or have any concerns, they should not hesitate to discuss it with the doctor. If the doctor is giving them information and they do not understand that information, it is crucial that they say so. A lot of patients won't mm-hmm. because, well, I won't even go into why.
Well, actually, you should.
Well,
this is from your experience as a health provider.
So in the past, it was the doctor, this is what the doctor says, so this is what you do, period. Mm-hmm. It's different. We work together with our patients. I want my patient to totally understand what's going on with their care, with their health. I want them to know why I'm doing a certain thing, why I'm performing certain tests, why I am prescribing certain medication. And I want them, it's a journey for the patient, but I really want them to learn about their health, the medications, what they're on, why they're on it. That's a challenge also for many patients.
The voice you hear is Dr. Denise Bell Carter, and we're talking about those annual physicals that we all should get. Let's focus on the fellows. Are we finished with the women? So we don't have this list? Anything else?
List, and then we also screen blood work. We check cholesterol. We check to see if there's any cardiac risk factors. We screen for diabetes.
And heart disease in women. We're going to talk about heart disease in another segment here on Closer Look. But heart disease in women particularly still continues to be one of the number one
leading cause
of death.
Of death, yes. So it is so important to tell your doctor about any symptoms that you're having.
Even if you think they're just minor.
Even if you think they're minor.
I had a friend that went to the doctor for pain or discomfort in her neck. She's actually a good friend of mine, a mentor. And then they kept her, and then she ended up having a triple bypass.
Exactly.
You knew where I was going with
jaw
that.
Jaw pain, left jaw pain, arm pain, yes. Chest pain, of course.
And she worked out regularly. Mm-hmm. I'd see her at the gym. She did Zumba and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Had no idea. But it was hereditary.
Yes. So had she come in and we knew it was hereditary, we knew her history, mm-hmm. her medical history or her family history, she would be screened.
Let's talk about the fellas. And I think mm-hmm. it's unfair to always say men don't go to the doctor.
They do.
They go to the doctor.
They do.
They're getting an annual checkup. Well, what should they be asking? What routine exam should they expect, doctor?
Okay, so for men, a lot of it's similar. The screening test, diabetes, hypertension, but also for the colorectal exam, it's pretty much the same. For men who smoke, who have a history of smoking cigarettes and they're at a certain age, between 65, 75, they should have an abdominal ultrasound to rule out an aortic abdominal mm-hmm. Aneurysm. And so that's probably the only difference with men. They don't push for prostate screening as much anymore mm-hmm. unless there is a family history of prostate cancer.
I had someone email me about this segment coming up, and they wanted me to ask our guest about what should transgender people also be asking and telling their doctor. And it never really occurred to me, and I'm glad that the person sent me that email in terms of what they, and obviously I'm sure their doctor should know about the transformation. We hope. But there's something they wanted to know. Should they change their primary care physician, or should most primary care physicians know how to give an annual checkup to someone who's transgender or who is transitioning?
Actually, many providers do not know, but have access to that information. So I think open dialogue with the provider, with the person's doctor mm-hmm. is very important, because it's easy to access the information. It's easy to go to a conference and learn. So if you have a patient who is transgender, you can learn about what you need to do easily. You can also reach out to other specialists.
I won't put you on the spot in terms of a political question, but this is nothing new. The issues, dialogue, narratives, debates about health care. But what do you think what message is missing when the policymakers are at the table trying to figure this out? What message do you think they're missing in terms of the common person who really just needs to have adequate health care as a part of I always love to say this, their quality of life? Do you think there's something the policymakers, and there are medical officials who are part of the policymakers.
Right. I just it just has to be a better way where people can have access to to health care, affordable access. There are a lot of people who obviously cannot afford it, and I think that those patients, everybody should be kept in mind. It's important. Everybody needs to have health care. What happens is if they don't, they end up in the emergency room, they end up in the hospital, so they're straining the system mm-hmm. anyway. So let's create a system where we have access for everyone, and no matter what your pay is, no matter how much money you make, you can access care for your health.
If you had your annual last year and you're feeling pretty good, should you go ahead and make the schedule for next year? Or do you, you know, I know we kind of talked about this coming into the segment, but not people like me who 2 years are away. But if you had that annual last year, you feel pretty good. Do you go ahead and schedule the other one?
I would. I you know, it is important to check certain things. We don't necessarily have to do all those screening tests every year, but get your blood pressure checked. Let's make sure your blood pressure is doing okay. You know, make sure everything's okay. But certain tests like the mammogram, women can choose yearly to have mm-hmm. that. Colonoscopy or the FIT test, the stool test that we do, that's yearly. So there's certain things that we would look at yearly to make sure everything is okay.
Do you go every year and get your annual
that
exam?
That is just not a fair question.
What do you mean it's not fair? You just got on me. You gave me the side eye. Everybody.
So let me say it like this. I know that I'm doing okay. I know
my blood pressure is just
wonderful.
Doctor.
Yeah,
and you're married to a doctor.
So, yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Does he go every year?
He goes. Yes, he goes. Yes.
He just lectured me about not getting to the doctor.
No. I have access. So I know certain things. I know what my blood pressure is.
I can go to Publix and check mine.
Well, then check it. That's great. But that's great because then you know, because I have patients who come in and their blood pressure is sky high mm-hmm. and I ask, how long has it been like that? And they have no clue.
I don't know.
Yeah. And it makes a difference.
That's why I'm here talking to you, Doc.
Yeah.
Dr. Denise Bell Carter, thank you so much for coming in and taking the time. And all of the recommendations that you heard today on Closer Look is because obviously Dr. Bell Carter is an expert, but we encourage you to speak to your own primary care physician. Don't say that Dr. Carter said on the Rose Scott Show that I ain't need to be here this year.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, as you all know, it is Health and Wellness Week here on Closer Look. So because we care about our fellow public broadcasting Atlanta colleagues, producer Ebony Lemon asked the question, hey, how do you stay healthy?
To stay healthy, I go for at least a half hour walk, mostly every day.
Consistently, I don't honestly do anything particularly to stay healthy, but I have increased my water intake.
To stay healthy, I try to be more intentional about committing to the portion size. I'm trying to cut out sodas and pasta and all the sweets out of my diet. If I do add it, I'll just try to be, like I said, just conscious about the actual portion size and not try to overdo it.
I took up cycling a few months ago. I decided I'd had enough of running after I turned 50, trying to not fall apart.
So to stay healthy, I've actually become paleo, which means that I don't eat any grains, I don't eat any sugar, and I did that after I was diagnosed with cancer, so it helps to fight that as well.
So I try to go to bed before midnight every night. I also try to drink a lot of water. I'm not as good about it some days than others, but I definitely feel better. I also feel like it balances out how much coffee I drink.
I try to avoid processed food as much as possible, but like, for example, for lunch every day, I'll have peanut butter and jelly and some sort of fruit. And then I started taking swimming classes at Agnes Scott recently, so that's been fun.
I do workout videos in the morning. I love Jillian Michaels. My sister-in-law got me into her. I also wear a Fitbit and track what I eat. We have a family history of high cholesterol, so what I put into my body is very important to me.
Wow, I work with some very healthy people. No processed foods, no coffee, no sodas, no pasta, no sweets. I'm in trouble. This is Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from WellStar Kennestone Hospital, which received Gold Seal distinction for heart valve, coronary artery bypass surgery, and congestive heart failure. Kennestone is one of only two programs in the country to receive this distinction. WellStar.org. And from Live Nation, welcoming the Eagles to Phillips Arena on Friday, October 20th. Tickets go on sale this Saturday at 10 a.m. at Ticketmaster.com. That's the Eagles at Phillips Arena on Friday, October 20th.
My name is Will, and I live in Decatur. I would say it's like a university town, but with adults, more adults. I like that it's close to Atlanta, but it's also its own kind of town. Well, I like downtown Decatur. It's easier to walk around. It's less spread out. Not really wild about the strip mall parts of like Lawrenceville Highway and North Druid Hills. Like the traffic's really bad, and I don't know how many more McDonald's we need.
Did you miss some of today's interview? Don't worry. Catch each day's show at wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email at rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
I'm Robin Young. Playwright Kate Hamill has a new stage adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, and her irreverent version draws on Austen's cheekier side.
She was very cutting and funny and witty and incisive and sarcastic and could be quite mean if you read her letters.
Next time, here and now.
This afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. According to the Atlanta-based Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the leading cause of death in the United States is heart disease, killing more than 600,000 people a year. Though heart disease affects millions of people, as a whole, the disease has been decreasing about 60% in the last 50 years. But check this out. In those 50 years, the pace of decline was slower for blacks compared to whites, and slower in counties with a concentrated history of slavery. In other words, a new research study has found a potential link between U.S. counties with a history of slavery and slower rates of decline in heart disease mortality for African Americans. We'll learn more about the study from Dr. Michael Kramer, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Emory University. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Rose. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for being here. I guess here's the first question. Did you all set out to see if there was a correlation between the heart disease decline and mortality rate for African Americans in these slaveholding regions? Or in other words, how did all this come about?
That's a great question. We actually didn't start off with that in mind. We were doing some work on the declines in heart disease. As you said there, although heart disease mortality is still the leading cause of death in the United States, amazingly, we've seen a 50 to 60% decline in the last 50 years. So it's really, it stands out as a substantial public health success story, things that have worked well. But as we began to dig into those declines, we realized that the pace of progress, the speed of decline, actually varies by race and by place. And so we were carrying out a number of studies. I've been working also with some colleagues at CDC, carrying out a number of studies asking questions about who and where goes down faster or slower. Separately from that, a colleague sent me a map from the Civil War, a map that apparently Abraham Lincoln produced of the concentration of slaves in 1860 across southern counties. And Lincoln was using this for planning during the Civil War. And I was struck, after spending months looking at maps of declines in heart disease mortality, at how these maps of declines, the places that go fast and slow, look so much like this map from history, from 1860, and slave concentration. And so that began a couple years ago, a process of learning about this literature.
I understand when there was the maps of the cluster of slave concentration in 1860, and then the cluster of the decline in heart disease mortality in blacks, when you put those two maps over each other, they were primarily, it was a fit.
It was a fit. It's not a perfect fit, and we can talk a little bit about ways that it's different, but it was surprisingly a fit. So one thing that's interesting, if we look at declines for whites and for blacks in the South, There are counties that are faster and slower for both whites and for blacks, but they're not actually the same counties. So the concentration of slow decline for blacks seems to be particularly in counties that have this legacy or history of slavery. There are definitely counties that were slower declines for whites, but they're in different places in the South.
Let's paint the picture, so to speak. Let's give this map. What region are we talking about? You're primarily going to talk about the South, I'm assuming, here, but are we talking from maybe parts of Texas all the way to Florida or to South Carolina, North Carolina? What are the boundaries here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, we can think about decline happening across the entire U.S., and there's variation across the U.S. Mm-hmm. Overall, the South has slower decline than other parts. So the South as a region stands out from the Northeast, Midwest, and West. But within the South, so as you said, from Texas east and from Florida up to the upper South states of Tennessee, West Virginia, Virginia, Missouri, Arkansas. So we're kind of looking at that range of the Southeast. And actually, in one part of the study, we actually separated by the Deep South, the original Confederate states, and the Upper South.
Was there one state in particular where you saw a high percentage of this slower pace of heart disease declining?
So there are pockets in many places. Certainly the largest pocket of slow decline is in the Deep South, Mississippi Delta, Louisiana, Alabama. There were relatively average declines in Georgia and South Carolina, and even somewhat faster than average within the South declines in North Carolina and Virginia. So there's variation across the South.
The voice you hear is Dr. Michael Kramer, an associate professor of epidemiology at Emory University, and we're discussing a study that shows the decline of heart disease is slower in regions that were concentrated by slaves or slavery. Now, you know, someone listening is saying, well, how can you map this? Is it fair to make this equate to slave-holding regions?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question and one that we struggled with a lot. And I want to be clear that this is a ecologic or a correlational study of units of space. So it's a high level picture. But I maybe want to paint two parts of that story. Mm-hmm. One is when we talk about this differences in decline, it's not the same as looking at a snapshot of the rate of heart disease in 2017. We're talking about the pace of progress. And so the things that caused the declines were advances in our understanding and knowledge about heart disease and how to prevent it and how to treat it. So what happened is we learned new things about smoking or about food quality or about screening, as the previous speaker was talking about, screening for hypertension, treating it, screening for cholesterol. We learned these new things. We continually learn new things. As we learn them, those new technologies diffuse through the population. They're made available to people through their doctors or through their community leaders. So one question was, are there places or people for whom progress is received more slowly? The diffusion is slowed. So that was one part of the story, that we might think of progress as being slowed by or accelerated by how we where we are, our status, and our relationship to information.
And there have been many reports. The data is there. It shows, as a journalist, I've covered so many stories about the stroke belt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about higher percentages of hypertension in the South, heart disease, the obesity rate. So it's nothing new when you have these medical ailments which show a higher percentage in the African-American community, and particularly in the South, so that's nothing new. And if you're talking about slower rates, this decline has been so slow in these last 50 years, you'd mentioned food quality and other issues. So it's a potential link when you think of the quality of life and access to things that you need to not have a high rate of heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
One could say, well, that's plausible. It makes sense.
One thing we think about is this idea of the geography of opportunity, that the opportunity structures, the things that help us be healthy and nourish all of us, are partly about the places, the environments we live, the schools that we have access to, the food environments we have access to, the employment opportunities that we have access to, the physical environments like air pollution and things like that.
But what does this say, doctor, about risk factors in developing heart disease? Or are you just really trying not to make that correlation? If you live in the South, you live in the southern part of this particular state, you're going to get heart disease. Obviously, you don't want to say that. But what are there risk factors you feel comfortable saying could, you know, be a factor in developing heart disease for African Americans?
Well, there is a large literature that's well outside the scope of this paper about risk factors for heart disease that include diet, physical activities, diabetes, smoking. When we think about this linkage to history or to place, we might ask about what are the things that accelerate or decelerate the uptake, the adoption of those behaviors. You know, a lot of times we focus a lot of attention on how can we get individuals to have better health behaviors? And that's critically important. Individuals have a lot of ability to really shape their life trajectory. But they exist in a context, and the set of choices they have is somewhat patterned by that context. So how can we think about that?
And the set of choices that we cannot control, and we talked about this in the first segment, is if there's a condition that's hereditary.
Mm-hmm.
So if you talk about a history of heart disease, particularly in people of color, that is something that we can't control. But you bring out an important part here that race and place could play a part in that.
Absolutely. Family history is clearly an important risk factor for heart disease, but we should by no means feel, for the most part, there are individual, relatively rare genetic conditions that really have a high likelihood of being transmitted. But for the most part, we shouldn't feel like our genes are our destiny. I think that there's a lot. The fact that we see variation in these rates and declines across the South among blacks, among a population that's otherwise ancestrally similar, mm-hmm. suggests that it's things about the environment and the localities and not things about their individual genes, because we all have more or less risk, but what environment that exists in is important.
You all released these findings earlier this month. Have you had some interesting feedback?
There's been a little bit of pushback, certainly, about the idea of this. I've been thinking about this for quite a while, and so I've begun to tease apart the strands that hold the history of slavery 150 years ago to the mm-hmm. declines at the end of the 20th century. But when people first hear that, it feels like a stretch. And I think it's an exciting opportunity to talk about the fact that place is an important part, and that history, not only the history of our lives as individuals, when the age at which we start smoking or whether we develop obesity as children, but the history of our places are contributors, and that if we want to affect change in heart disease or in other chronic disease, we want to engage with all of those, not just with telling individuals to behave better, but also with improving the environments in which they live.
You just mentioned you received some pushback from your fellow colleagues in the medical industry from either here or far away?
Yeah, from colleagues who, in clinical medicine, some in public health. In my particular circle, we do a lot of work thinking about place and health.
What'd you hear?
Pardon me?
What did you hear? Give me some specifics on the feedback. You don't have to mention names.
Yeah,
but,
right.
You
know, I think
unless you want to.
I think people feel like it's too big a stretch to talk. For example, we're always cautious about attributing cause and effect. Did the history of slavery cause this decline? Mm-hmm. What we're observing is this pattern that declines were faster in some of these places, and so it's an opportunity to ask why.
Because science is supposed to deal in facts primarily, only.
Science deals in facts, but facts are continually evolving as we learn new information. We put out an idea and people try to push back and disprove it, and that's a useful part of the process.
So what do you all do with this information? What's next?
Yeah. So, this tells us something about what has already happened. The history of slavery we can't change in the South, and the history of recent declines we can't change. But what we can do is we can say, taking this information, taking this idea that place is important and that the life course of individuals is important, we can reimagine what would be a public health intervention that would make equitable reductions in heart disease mortality. And maybe what that means is we need to think about the roles of education and employment and housing, as well as food and activity environments, smoking environments, laws around smoking bans, and this whole myriad of factors that lead us or contribute to the behaviors that individuals make so that they can be as healthy as possible in their lives.
And then you're also, as we wrap up, we're also talking about just access, because I imagine some of these counties, if you're talking about the Deep South, and this is, we have facts on this, access to health care is a barrier, is a challenge for a lot of people. But when you get into these rural communities and you're talking about the Deep South, it's a huge factor.
Mm-hmm.
It's critical.
And access is about insurance, so that's the debate that's going on nationally. But access is also, I think, as you're pointing out, about under health professional shortage areas. Are there places where there simply aren't enough physicians or maybe not enough cardiologists? Access is about transportation. Access might be about childcare. Mm-hmm. You know, can you get to the doctor if you have to take care of your babies or your grandbabies? So there are many parts to access, and we can think of it partly about insurance, and that's a really important one, but it's not only about insurance. It's also about how do we feel comfortable and capable of getting to the healthcare that we need.
Dr. Michael Kramer, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Emory University. We've been talking about this new research study that found a potential link between U.S. counties with a history of slavery and slower rates of decline in heart disease mortality for African Americans. Dr. Kramer, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for WABE comes from Reliable Heating and Air, a Trane dealer, a family company since 1978 offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at reliableair.com.
As the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium opens later this month, we take a look. How will it change the local economy and neighborhoods on the west side? What were the past promises for Atlanta stadiums, and what's the current reality? Join WABE reporter Stephanie Stokes at our next community conversation, The Impact of New Stadiums, Tuesday, August 22nd at 6:30 at the Atlanta University Center's Woodruff Library. For more information and to reserve your free ticket, go to wabe.org/community.
If you missed any part of today's show, we got you. You can catch up on all the interviews you missed at wabe.org/closerlook. And let me know what you think. Tweet me at WABE Rose Scott or send an email to rose@wabe.org. This is member supported 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
My name is Kathy, and I work in the West End neighborhood. I've been working in the West End since 1995. The most change that I see over in this West End is that they are putting in a few stores. So far, not that much difference. They've done some beautification as far as planting trees and little artwork and stuff on the sidewalks and in the middle of the streets in some places. You know, you have all the colleges down the street. You have the Wren's Nest right down Ralph Abernathy. This is the historical West End.
On the next Fresh Air, performer Bridget Everett. Her raunchy comedy cabaret act showcases her wild sexual humor, her beautiful singing voice, and her 6-foot-tall, plus-sized body. She's been featured on Amy Schumer's TV series and is in the new film Patty Cakes. Also, actor John Cho, best known for his role in the Harold and Kumar comedies. Join us
this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. There was a time when your local newspaper provided all the daily news. There was a morning edition and an evening edition, and no Steve Inskeep. Then came radio, and sometimes your international news and even war updates were played at the local movie theater. We also had television. Now, for some people, Twitter is all they need for news. What's news for you may not be news for someone else, and vice versa. We know that, right? For a city like Atlanta and its surrounding regions, news coverage must be diverse and reaching a diverse population. And that's why now I'm joined by Lee Wong, publisher at Georgia Asia Times, Shuab Hanif, executive director of AtlantaMuslim.com, and Gina Sandoval, news director and executive producer at Telemundo. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I want to begin with this because given what's taken place the last year with the new administration, attacks on some media outlets, the use of fake news, issues about should reporters be more less objective, and should reporters be more opinionated, things of that nature. I just kind of want to get your take, personal take on, are you concerned about where news is going in terms of how we disseminate information to our consumers, our people? Are you concerned at all? Jean, I'll start with you.
Well, actually, yes, I am a little bit concerned. First of all, not only because of the criticism towards our profession, mm-hmm. but also because I do see that our profession is changing in ways that can be also dangerous and can be also taken as not being objective. Mm-hmm. I think that we are in a moment that we as journalists should really think what is our responsibility in society. Some of us or some companies have gone the way of having more journalists or people that talk and just give opinions.
More without editorials really, as opposed to journalists.
Exactly, without really taking into care the facts. We have lost that investigative area of journalism, like really looking not only at what the politicians are saying, but what is the people really doing and working and living, and what is why this took us to the place that we are right now.
Lee, what about you? What are your concerns?
Yeah, my biggest concern is it's very un-American, because it seems like lately all the news are divided into fake news and branded a certain way, and it's like I'm worried about the objectivity of journalism, mm-hmm. you know? Like the famous tagline on Washington Post, you know, democracy dies in darkness. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned about that. And because right now, journalists is been challenged every day by the administrators in Washington. And we on the ground level have to work harder, have to be even more objective in bringing the facts and what's really going on to share with our community.
Mm. Schwab, what do you mean?
Rose, thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. And I share the same sentiments as my colleagues here. I think the objectivity is lost, but at the same time, I think there's a lot of people preying on fear that people have. And I think there is responsibility to be shared by the journalists to bring in the objectivity, to talk about what is happening. And you know, from the Muslim community, the community has been confronting these issues for a long time. So on our side, we seem to want to talk about what are the real issues, what are the real challenges, and how do you fight this negative perception of Muslims?
Well, and Schwab, I want to stay with you for a segment, because you all are providing news for a specific population in relation to the other daily news.
Yes.
How do you stay objective when there are cries or allegations against Muslims? How do you stay objective when that's out in the news cycle?
I think it is easy to stay objective, because when you face these attacks, you know that they don't represent you. So part of it is, you know, reality, where you know these thugs and criminals who claim to do these things in the name of Islam, mm-hmm. they don't represent me. So we try to look at what is the community doing in reality. For example, just last week, I heard about one group of dentists, I think about 50 of them. They've held these free clinics for hundreds of people in the Metro Atlanta area. And so folks who don't have insurance, they go in and benefit from them. So nobody's talking about this, right? And for me, it's an amazing story. So those are the kind of stories that I want to focus on and let people know their reality.
Gina, over at Telemundo, and if I couldn't even guess how many times you all have had to cover immigration issues.
A daily.
daily.
It's on a daily basis. That is one of our, you know, top topics. But I do want to say that although immigration is you know, specifically a topic, we also have to fight the idea that immigration is the only topic that Hispanics are interested in. Mm-hmm. And because it's not true, we're interested in about economics, we're interested in about politics, we're interested in people having jobs. We have to admit that also there's crime among, you know, our community, that there's gangs in our community. There's about the 30 gangs that are in Atlanta. There's a whole bunch of them that are Hispanics. So mm-hmm. there's problems as a community that we do have and we need to acknowledge. But also we also have to think that not all Hispanics are interested in the immigration subject, and not only that. The illegal or the undocumented immigration, mm-hmm. but also how we're going to be solving mm-hmm. that for us and for the rest of the country.
Lee Wong over at Georgia Asia Times. And listen, when you talk about the Asian American population, you talk about the Asian population, there's a lot there to cover. So what are your daily challenges in trying to make sure you're covering the news for many different populations within your community?
Yes, the focus right now we are trying to cover more and more is more so on the emerging generations of Asian Americans. There's a growing interest among the young millennials, particularly aged between 18 to 30, that wants to run for office. And they want to have a voice. They want to have representation. Their thoughts process are very different from the parents who immigrate to this country. These are folks are known as the 1.5 or 2.0 generation. They may be born here, mm-hmm. or they may be born in Asia, but they have lived in this country from a very young age. They went to school and they went to colleges. They got good jobs. And now they felt that, hey, they need to be represented. They need to be heard. You know, and your voice count. Yeah.
How do you gauge, I'll start with you, I'll stay with you, Lee. How do you gauge what your audience or readers want to hear, what they need? What's their feedback to you all?
The feedback is very simple. It's based on the social media interaction that we have with them, and also the amount of day-to-day activity that we cover on the ground, and also all the events that we organize regularly throughout the year. Both culturally and also business events that we cover, we get very good direct response and feedback from the community.
Schwab, what about you? How do y'all gauge what your readers want to read?
I think topics to cover is one problem the Muslim community does not have, because if you go to any mosque or any place, you'll find that there are a lot of diversity in the constituents that are there. So everyone has their own perspective that they bring to the table. So it's easy to talk about their different opinions, and sometimes, you know, other people enjoy learning from it. And obviously there's a lot of racism and things like that are taking place in our community. And I think the last article one of our members wrote addresses some of those things, mm-hmm. and say, okay, how do we deal with, you know, looking at our own house before we talk about everybody else?
Gina, what about you all? How do you gauge what your viewers want to hear?
Well, we have a very good, strong following on Facebook, over 200,000 people. We don't do much Twitter because the Hispanics in this area don't do much Twitter. Mm-hmm. But we have several events throughout the year. We have a lot of interaction with the community. We have events. We have recognition. For example, we're going to have a heroes recognition to people who work a lot in the community. So sometimes people do call us and into the show and say, hey, you know, I'm having this problem. We need your help. So we keep those lines open, and we also have reporters. So when they go and cover stories, they get that interaction, that those comments from our viewers.
As for fellow journalists, we know there are probably not enough hours in the day for you to tackle everything you want to do in a 24-hour news cycle. But in your own individual news outlets, how are you guys doing in terms of staffing and funding and you know, if you're commercial, you know, making sure those ads are coming in? Basically, how are you doing financially?
I think we're doing good. We're trying actually to work to grow. We're growing into the digital side. We have a lot of TV viewers, but we know what the future of the media is. The future of the media is digital. No matter where you look at it, you have to go into you know, a web page and a website and social media. So we're trying to evolve into that area, and those are our projects, and we're doing very good in that side.
What about you, Ollie?
We are doing fantastic. Business couldn't be better. I couldn't complain. We made the transition from hard copy print to digital back in 2010.
Digital solely?
Solely, yes. Wow. And we made that hard call during the economic downturn, and we haven't regretted it one day since then. Yeah.
Shuaib, what about you all?
So AtlantaMuslim.com is the largest community-run web publication for Muslims in Atlanta. Like many organizations, small media organizations, they struggle with funding and declining revenues. But our challenge is that we are completely volunteer-run. Yes.
Really?
And the young people get journalism experience by working with us, and many of them have moved on to work in prominent news agencies. We do have copy editors, story editors, and publishers who donate their time. And my job is to keep them motivated to
deliver.
How do
you do that?
I think the team, you hear this, it's almost like cliche that they're passionate, but they have to be in order to be involved. So it makes it a lot easier.
Lee, when a young journalist comes to you and they say, well, what kind of advice can you give me? What do you tell them?
Just prepare to work hard, be objective, and be fair, you know, in your view towards what you see in the world. That's very key.
Gina?
Oh, check your facts double.
Yeah, I've said that so many times around here. Check your facts.
Yeah, so that's actually what I tell all my reporters. Before saying something or publishing something, we need to verify, because there's nothing that damages more a journalist than saying something that is not true.
And you have to retract it.
Yes.
When I speak to young journalism students all the time, they always want to know, how do you break news? How do you break news? And I always say the same thing. I am not interested in being first. I'm interested in being right.
Exactly.
Because what people will remember, Candace Wheeler, my producer would tell you, they will remember when you got it wrong. And they won't let you forget when you've got it wrong. Lee Wong, publisher at Georgia Asia Times, Shuaib Hanif, executive director of AtlantaMuslim.com, and Gina Sandoval, news director and executive producer at Telemundo. Thank you all for coming in and speaking with me. It's always great to talk to fellow journalists.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. Closer Look was produced by the extraordinary Candace Wheeler and the extraordinary Ebony Lemon and Finley Fox. And our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer is Christine Dipsey. A special thanks always to the entire WABE News team. By the way, they always check their facts. As well as Public Broadcasting Atlanta's digital services crew. We're back tomorrow at 1 for another edition of Closer Look. If you missed any of today's show, just go online at wabe.org/closerlook. And you can now listen to Closer Look weeknights at 9 p.m. I'm Rose Scott. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's Choice for NPR.